Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up today, celebrating consecrated life. We hear from the Secretary of the Vatican Office, responsible for institutes of consecrated life, and why one woman gave everything and forever to Christ. They're the glue that keeps the church together, the religious and lay people who consecrate their lives to Christ and bear witness to His love through ministry and charity. Each year, the church celebrates consecrated life on February 2nd, and this year is no exception. Pope Benedict will be presiding in evening vespers in St. Peter's Basilica. When most people think of consecrated persons, they think first of religious men and women. But some of our listeners might be surprised to learn there are other forms of consecrated life, such as consecrated virgins and consecrated hermits. Well, I asked the Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life, Archbishop Joseph Tobin, what sets consecrated people apart from the rest of the faithful?
Like any vocation, to be a consecrated virgin or a hermit or a Jesuit or a sister of charity, a daughter of charity, ultimately traces its root to the divine impulse, you know, to the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And the church as sort of the custodian of God's gifts and helps consecrate people who feel this impulse to live it in syntony with the gospel and with the Catholic tradition. So to say that a hermit is a member of the consecrated life, yes, I think that, you know, that stretches it a bit. What is difficult in that case to always to understand is the community dimension, because a hermit by definition
is someone who pulls himself away from society.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. These are ancient vocations in the church. I mean, the vocation to hermit, in fact, St. Anthony began his life as a hermit, as someone who lived apart. He sold all that he had and provided for his younger sister, which was good of him, and then went out into the desert of Egypt. And there were other people who sort of felt drawn by the example of his life to accompany him. And so the hermit was no longer a hermit. Instead, he had a community of men around him that were, and then later women, who followed his example.
Now, it was Pope John Paul II who instituted the World Day for Consecrated Life back in 1997. In his homily for the very first celebration on February 2nd that year, he said, "The observance is intended to help the entire church to esteem ever more greatly the witness of those persons who have chosen to follow Christ by means of the practice of the evangelical councils, and at the same time is intended to be a suitable occasion for consecrated persons to renew their commitment and rekindle the fervor which should inspire their offering of themselves to the Lord." Now here we are, 2011, that's some 14 years later, in a very changed world. How do you think Pope Benedict sees this World Day for Consecrated Life?
Well, I think he appreciates the inspiration of his predecessor. Pope Benedict will be with members of the Consecrated Life on February 2nd to celebrate evening prayer in the Basilica of St. Peter's. And he'll give a homily to the members there that I'm sure will be later communicated around the world. I think that it's important to look at the original inspiration of Pope John Paul II, that this was not simply for consecrated people, but it's for the church. And it's to remind the church of the presence of this particular vocation, which he judged himself. I think if you read some of his own writing, especially the apostolic exhortation Vita Consecrata, that he saw it as something quite important and one would even say essential for the church's life. So I think the celebration of February the 2nd was first and foremost for the church to remind the faithful of the beauty, the importance of this vocation.
Now, Pope Benedict himself has likened consecrated life to a plant with many branches, which sinks its roots into the gospel and brings forth abundant fruit in every season of the church's life. But he's also called consecrated men and women a bridge to God for all those he or she meet, a call and a return. What is the Pope, do you think, expecting of the faithful here and the consecrated?
Well, I think that of the consecrated life, I mean, I like his example of a plant. I mean, I often speak of it, of the consecrated life as a whole, because in my service to the Church, I deal with all a variety of forms of consecrated life, from monks to teaching religious, to missionaries, to people who live a contemplative or life that is in some way separated from the world. I think of taken together, it is a sort of ecosystem. And like the Amazonian rainforest, it's essential to the larger system of the church. Without that rainforest, we would find it very difficult to breathe because it provides oxygen for the world. And I think in some way the consecrated life should provide this oxygen for the church. Part of it, in drawing on that second, about the bridge example, is to illustrate the importance of God before all else. Because I think if you want to find the common denominator among religious, it's that. I mean, that whatever their particular work may be or their service, pastoral service, it's first and foremost a recognition of the supremacy of God and that everything that we are is conditioned by that. And so that perhaps the freedom, the joy, the hope that we religious find in pursuing our vocation and in recognition of the supremacy of God will also help married couples, single people, young people find joy and freedom and really the correct direction in their own lives.
I think, and also this Pope reminded us of the importance of silence in our lives, in this world that is so noisy, so we're bombarded with so many images and sounds, the importance of silence.
I think you're right. And he reminds us in very practical ways, like his own practice and really expectation that other celebrants follow the practice of, after the gospel, of just being quiet for a moment, you know, to allow the word of God to resonate and speak within us. We are surrounded by a lot of words, and I remember once reading in a manual of management that said, formerly, a practice was to withhold information so you could guarantee your importance in a structure. Now it's simply to bombard people with words, and then no one really knows what's important or not. And I think that silence can help us understand and witness to the one thing necessary.
Now, people were shocked by the clerical abuse, sex abuse crisis, and revelations that the leader of at least one institute for religious life had seriously compromised his vows and the trust of his followers. And here I'm thinking in particular of the Legionaries of Christ. The faithful, many young seminarians and priests have felt, quite frankly, betrayed by those who they once trusted. To what extent have these scandals taken a toll, do you think, on vocations in the church? And do you think enough has been done to purge this behavior from the church and ensure that it never happens again?
Well, there are several questions there. I mean, the first regards scandal. And, you know, Jesus was very, very, used very strong language about scandal, because I think he knew in his compassionate heart just what damage can be done. The people of this city recognized it millennia ago when they started, had a proverb that said, corruptio optima pessima, the corruption of the best is the worst. And that's exactly true, because it leaves people cynical or dubious regarding the authenticity of anybody who tries to do good things. Now, I think in that sense, religious and priests across the world, in my experience, have been touched and hurt by the scandals such as the one you just touched upon, because all of us feel a bit suspect, you know. I've also found that if people know us, and they eventually will form their own judgment about whether we're the real deal or not. And I think that the church, both locally and universally, is making serious efforts and progress to ensure that, to the best we can, that scandals don't occur. I don't think we can give 100% guarantee, because finally people are free, and they're free to choose very evil things. It's my belief, and I'm by nature an optimist, that people don't go out of their way to choose evil. And however, I do believe that religious leaders have a special responsibility to offer a witness that's transparent in all senses of the word. And when we don't do that, the price is very severe. Now, I'm glad to see that, you know, I can speak, for example, of some dioceses in the United States. I understand where there were some very public and damaging scandals, that the vocations to the diocesan priesthood and some religious institutes has not disappeared. I mean, in fact, it's recovered and seems to be going well. But that's not, I'm not Pollyanna. I don't think that, I think that some very severe wounds have been inflicted on the church. And I think the Holy Father is one of the first to recognize that.
And you there at the congregation, are you able to offer any kind of practical support for people, for example, as these seminarians and the legionaries, you know, who've suffered this trauma? Are you able to offer any kind of spiritual, practical support?
Well, I think, you know, if you're speaking about the specific case of the legionaries, the Holy Father has, you know, reached out, and both in responsibility to correct the errors, that the sin, the evil that has been unleashed, but also to care for the people who have been crushed and wounded by the evil choices of people they respected in authority. So the Holy Father has provided, you know, a group of cardinals and that are accompanying the legion led by Cardinal de Paulus. For ourselves, we deal sometimes with particular cases of members of a religious order that find themselves in crisis, trying to find a solution that's consistent with the values of the gospel and the church's tradition. We also try to take preventative measures, in the sense that when we look at the state of a religious order, you know, its own self-examination, we pay special attention to the formation that's being given to enter the selection of candidates, and to ensure that the beauty of that particular vocation is reflected in the care with which candidates are admitted and later formed.
Pope John Paul II suggested that consecrated people not only, and these are his words, have a glorious history to remember and to recount, but also a great history still to be accomplished. He said, look to the future where the Spirit is sending you in order to do even greater things. And Pope Benedict, too, is urging people, it seems to me, to rekindle the enthusiasm for the faith that the first Christian communities enjoyed. And this in a world today where religion is more and more seen as a source of conflict or of division. From here, then, what future for consecrated life?
Well, I you won't be surprised if I tell you that I agree with both pontiffs there. I think the words of Pope John Paul that you quoted to conclude Vita Consecrata are a very salutary reminder to religious who, at times, looking at the limited horizon of this moment of history, may feel very discouraged. And I think they're with reason in some contexts. What are the reasons for hope? Well, I think the reasons for hope is that this, finally, religious life or consecrated life isn't simply a human project. It isn't that the founders like St. Ignatius Loyola or St. Francis de Sales or Dominic or Jean-François de Chantel or any of them sat down and said, you know, I think it's a good idea to found a religious order. It was the impulse of God. It was the work of God in giving a gift to the church. And that's what charism finally means. It's a gift. So to conclude the consecrated life is over, I mean, you'd have to say, well, then God chooses not to give gifts to the church any longer. I mean, this is a gift among other gifts. And so, yes, and I think there are very practical possibilities for the service of the consecrated life to the church and to the world. For example, you mentioned about the marginalization of religion and the growth of division. Well, consecrated life is a reality that goes beyond national borders. I mean, many of the really thriving religious orders and congregations today are multinational groups, multicultural groups. And they're groups that, in my mind, prolong the miracle of Pentecost. Not simply that the good news is heard in all, you know, in everybody's language, but that the good news doesn't require people to forfeit the richness of their own tradition or their culture. And so while it's not always easy, I think at our best, we reflect a Catholic church in a microcosm, that a religious order or religious congregation, while very attentive to the local circumstances, is a reality that also witnesses to the God who loves and enters all of human reality.
And a very warm thanks there to Archbishop Joseph Tobin, Secretary of the Pontifical Congregation for Institutes of Consecrated Life. And now, why would anyone want to become a nun? Stick around for the next story to find out. She's a handsome young woman whose decision to enter a Catholic missionary order undoubtedly broke a few hearts. Spanish-born Camboni sister Alicia Vacas is anything but the stereotypical image some people have of nuns, that they're a bunch of elderly women praying in a convent. Well, Sister Alicia trained as a nurse, formerly stationed in Europe and Egypt. For the past few years at the Camboni Convent in Jerusalem, she has dedicated herself to helping needy Palestinians and the migrant and poor communities in Israel. Collaborating with the Israeli aid organization Physicians for Human Rights, Sister Alicia was part of the team which conducted medical research into human rights violations following Israel's three-week incursion in the Gaza Strip in the winter of 2008 and 2009. Well, with a sparkle in her eye, Sister Alicia told me she knew early on that she had a special calling to Christ, and once she made her mind up to become a nun, she was determined to give him everything and forever. Come join me as I ask her to share with us her story.
I come from a traditional religious family, so religion and prayer was part of my life from the very beginning, and so was also a social commitment and work with poor people or people at the margins of society. And this part of my life became more and more important as I was growing up, and I was lucky enough to find a group of people, young people like me, who were growing in the same direction. At the beginning, I have to say that my direction was much more social. And for a while, the commitment with the poor and African problems were taking over my energies. And when I came to know the Camboni family, the fathers and sisters who were working together with youth in Spain, I felt that something clicked in my life, that both sides of my life, this social tension and also the religious inquietude within me, fit together. So when I knew the Camboni fathers and sisters in the meeting for young people, I really felt that this kind of life could be my life. Still, I had a lot of dreams. I was a teenager. I was finishing high school, so I wanted to study medicine and to go to Africa. But at the same time, I wanted to have a family, and I had a sort of boyfriend, and so life became very complicated making choices at that time. But I think that slowly they helped me to make like a personal journey of prayer and discernment. And there were two main ideas, like two voices coming very strongly to me, especially when I had to choose which kind of commitment I would like to have with Africa, with the poor, with the mission. And the words coming to me were always everything and forever. I didn't want to give to the mission a part of my life, my professional career, the first years of my marriage, it was clear to me that I wanted to give to the poor and to Jesus everything and forever. So it became closer and closer to the idea of consecration, and it helped me a lot to make choices in life. Mm. So when I finished high school, I had to choose between going to the university and joining the community. Actually, at that moment, the community preferred that I went to the university and grew up a bit and became more mature. But for me, it was clear enough at that time. So after a process of discernment together, they accepted me, and I'm happy that they did it.
Mm. Sometimes families these days have fewer and fewer children. And so how did your family take it that you wanted to go into religious life?
Well, as I told you before, I come from a traditional family, so we are six children. Mm-hmm. I am from the youngest part of the family. And I have to say that there were two different reactions. My parents are very religious, simple people. My father has also two sisters who are sisters in different communities. So for them, it was a joy, I have to say. And they just didn't like that I chose a missionary congregation, so I was supposed to go abroad from the very beginning, and they thought I was so young and it was dangerous, and they would rather prefer me in a local congregation like my aunties, working in schools so with the poor but close home. And, then my brothers and sisters, they are from another generation. They are not especially religious, and they are much more worried and concerned about social issues. They were telling me just the opposite. If you want to work with the poor, it's fine, but what do you need to be a sister? You can do it as a married person, you can be a single, you can do other things and keep your freedom and your money. And so there were different positions, but they have to say that they were very supportive, all of them, and I never had trouble in sharing with them my choices.
Hmm. Where were you sent first in your first mission away from home?
Well, I left Spain during the process of training at the very beginning of religious life, much before starting the mission. I came to Italy for studies and in the process of formation or training. And then after my first vows, I was sent to a house of elder sisters in Erba at the north of Italy, to help the elder sisters. Then I went back to Spain for studies and I did nursing training. And then my missionary life started. At the beginning, I went to Dubai, and from Dubai to Egypt. I was in Egypt for 9 years. And it has been the most important part of my missionary life. And then from Egypt, I was sent to the Holy Land. And I have been in Jerusalem for 1.5 years now.
And so you were able to reconcile this spiritual calling with your interest and your passion also for medicine. Mm-hmm. How did the religious order help you achieve that?
I think there was a wonderful journey process of discernment together. Because actually, since I joined very young and I didn't have specific professional formation, no training, I was given the chance to say my opinion or what I wanted to do, to become. And they have other opinions different from mine. So
why? What did they want from you?
Well, when I was still a novice, there were several proposals. And for them, it was a good idea if I studied something like journalism, for instance, or mass media, something that could use social skills and communication. And it was very far from my intention. So we made the process of discernment together, and I said my opinion that I think that in my life, in the same way that there is a call for religious life and for consecration, there is a call for taking care of, call it medicine or nursing or counseling. There are many different expressions, but the direction was very clear for me, and it is so easy for me to reconcile within myself these two aspects of my life, since I can do any other thing. I could do the journalist or any other kind of job, but then it become a profession. But my profession as a nurse is spontaneously part of my consecration. And I think they understood it very well, and I was allowed to study nursing. And it's quite curious that just in the last few years, especially since I came to Jerusalem, these two aspects are coming together again, and I am called more and more often to talk here and there or to participate in some programs. And it's a bit funny that it is coming together again. But still, I feel that this part of my life as a nurse is an important part of my giving myself to others. Mm.
One of the things that I think that you have been seeking also, combining your spiritual life with your medical background. You've been also seeking ways to achieve justice in situations that are very, very serious in the Middle East in particular. How does that make you feel? What have you been able to accomplish as well?
Well, for me, it's just part of my vocation as a Comboni sister. We are Comboni sisters for the poor of the poorest. This is our expression, how we say it, to make a common cause, to share our lives with the poor. So also in my professional life as a nurse, seeking for those who have not access to medical care, for instance, is part of my consecration. And it has had different expressions in different moments of my life according to where I was. But in this moment in Jerusalem, for instance, it is translated in my commitment with Physicians for Human Rights. It is an Israeli organization, and it works for the right to health for everyone, especially in the cases in which it is threatened by the occupation. So we have mobile clinics reaching the most complicated areas in the West Bank. We have an open clinic in Tel Aviv for all those who don't have medical insurance or health insurance. So you have asylum seekers, refugees, migrant workers, clandestine Palestinians who live in Jerusalem or in Israel without papers, and also the poorest part of Israeli society, homeless, people in drugs, maybe. And at the same time, we work in Gaza, or we try to intervene in some situations, for instance, the permits to move freely within the West Bank or Gaza, and the access to medical care is threatened. So I find in this field a way of showing my love and allowing Jesus' love and Jesus' mercy to pass to all these populations, these peoples, both Israelis and Palestinians. And for me, it's a privilege working with both of them together. This is something that makes harmony in the around me.
How did you get from what would seem like a closed little life in a convent with maybe 12 other sisters there in Jerusalem to working with Physicians for Human Rights?
Well, I think my life has never been a closed life in a convent. Our life as Comboni sisters is a call to public life among the people, especially among the poorest. So it's spontaneous to look, wherever you are, to look around and say, where are the poor here? Who is serving the poor? Or who can I work with? In which way I can work with other people to improve the situation and to make Jesus present here. So when I arrived to Jerusalem, I did exactly the same. I tried to find who was working in this direction, since I am a nurse, who is working maybe from the medical point of view on human rights and on peacemaking, nonviolence process. So it was quite spontaneous. So we are not called to live in a little convent altogether. It's not our life.
And a very warm thanks there to Sister Alicia Vacas, a Comboni missionary sister. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.